Hello, everybody. Welcome back to For the Girls. Today we have a very exciting interview, so we're just going to jump right in. We are joined by Josh Robinson and John Clegg to discuss their new book, The Formula, How Rogues, Geniuses, there you go, and Speed Freaks Re-Engineered F1 into the World's Fastest Growing Sport. The book went live on March 12th, and it's an excellent read, so go check it out. So we'll do a little bit of background on both of you, and then we'll dive in on all the questions. So Josh has been the European sports correspondent for the Wall Street Journal for over a decade, and he's also covered other sports like the NFL, the Olympics, the Tour de France, personal favorite of my family's. He's also been featured in the New York Times, the Washington Post, Sports Illustrated, amongst other things. John is a senior editor for the Wall Street Journal, and he joined over 10 years ago as the paper's first Europe-based sports reporter, and you've since written about every major sport, including, of course, Formula One, which we will talk about today.
It. The best sport of all, of course.
We can just ignore all the other ones.
So let's start there. We discussed a little bit before we started rolling, but were you motorsport fans before this? And if you're allowed to share your allegiances, do you have a team or a driver that you root for?
So we both grew up in the UK in the 90s and the late 80s during the real first peak of F1. And so at that time, like, you couldn't ignore it. It was everywhere. And My allegiances in those days lay with Damon Hill, Williams' team, and staying up till 3 o'clock in the morning to watch watch him race in Suzuka.
Nice.
Yep, I was the same. This was back during the, like, Williams dominance of the early 90s. So Damon Hill, Nigel Mansell, all the British drivers, basically.
Do you still have allegiances to Williams?
Well, not really. I mean, I like to say that we shelved our allegiances when we became sports reporters,
yeah, so
we
don't really
follow any teams. But yeah, sort of 20, 30 years, whatever it is, of following F1.
Incredible. That's great. I also grew up in the UK, but more around the time that Lewis joined Mercedes, so that was, like, very exciting as well. So there are a lot of F1 books out there. We've read a few already. How did you decide the angles that you wanted to take with this? What makes it different from the other books that are out there?
So, John, you want to take it?
No, well, I think, you know, we felt that, the time was right for an F1 book. We've actually written a book previously about the rise of English soccer and the Premier League. And I think we saw a lot of parallels between what was happening to F1 in the last sort of 5 years mm-hmm. and where English soccer was when we embarked on that project sort of 10 years earlier, where it had suddenly sort of was a sport that had been on the periphery and was suddenly becoming, like, much more part of the mainstream in the mm-hmm. American sort of sports consciousness. So, it just seemed like the right time for an F1 book.
And I'd say a lot of the books on F1 that are out there are about one team, one driver, one season. What we wanted to do was kind of tie all of it together, whether it's the teams, the money, the forces that kind of shape it, and got us where we are today.
Yeah, that's what we love talking about. It really is so exciting.
Well, and it feels like we're living through it now. I mean, I'm a relatively new fan, relatively speaking, I guess, as an American who got into it during the pandemic with Drive to Survive and all of that. And it feels like we're living through this renaissance of Formula One, at least in the States, which is very cool.
Right. I think, you know, and I think it was sort of part of that like sort of propelled us to write the book was that a lot of people were sort of writing about Formula One's growing popularity and just sort of ascribing it purely to Drive to Survive.
Yeah.
Like, oh, you know, Liberty bought Formula One and they made this, like, documentary, and then all of a sudden F1 became this huge thing. And, you know, I think the story of why F1 has suddenly become popular is, like, a bit more complicated than you know, and can really be traced, like, sort of all the way back to, like, the very origins of F1 in terms of some of the kind of risk-taking and the sort of willingness to reinvent itself, which sort of manifested itself in Drive to Survive.
So would you say that the recent growth in F1 is not synonymous with the Americanization of F1, which is a term that a lot of people are throwing out these days?
I mean, I think, you know, those two things are very closely related in that sort of for a long time, America was the sort of last frontier for F1, one place that they hadn't been able to conquer. Even as the sport spread to, like, literally almost every country in the world, mm-hmm. like, America was this sort of great black hole, much to the chagrin of Bernie Eccleston for a long time. So I think, you know, definitely their sights were set on the US, and a lot of the focus and a lot of the way that they judge their own success is based on the sort of breakthrough that they've had in this country. But no, I think there's something sort of bigger than just the US. It's not only America that has seen the popularity of Formula One rise. This has been a global phenomenon. And Yeah. So I think they're related, but not exactly the same thing.
Do you think it's sustainable? A lot of people in the U.S. talk about how, you know, Austin has been more of a mainstay of in terms of races, but Miami, Vegas, they're a little bit less accessible to the normal fan. It's a little bit more about the spectacle, the glitz and glam. What does that mean for kind of long-term fandom and getting people excited about the sport and the racing rather than just the show? Do you feel like it's sustainable growth?
Well, I think F1 will tell you that, like, they've found the balance, that yeah. Austin is the one that's accessible that people can get to, and then Miami was basically the practice run for Vegas, and Vegas is now this insane product of sports in 2023 and 2024. But, you know, we know that they want to continue expanding, but we also know that 24 races is as far as they can go.
Yeah.
And the teams and the drivers will tell you that. Max Verstappen even says, if it goes over 24, I don't think I see myself staying around much longer.
We talked about that literally this week.
I also don't know how much they actually care about, like, how many people go to the races or yeah. even how many watch them on TV. Like, one of the things that we sort of get into at the very end of the book is this idea of F1 as sort of the first, like, kind of postmodern sport, post-sport, where there are people who sort of follow F1 and think of themselves as F1 fans, but don't actually watch the races, you know, because of all the drama that, like, Drive to Survive has brought to the surface, and you can kind of follow the soap opera part of the sport without necessarily tuning in to watch like 3 hours of racing every other Sunday. So, you know, I think F1 is cool with that. Like, that they recognize that there are going to be some people who prefer to consume the sport that way, and that's, you know, that's totally fine.
We definitely notice that with some of our listenership. We do a podcast where we do a recap for every single race, and I think not all of our listeners watch the races, but they're good to just kind of get the recap from our podcast and
yeah,
chat about the news and just better understand what's going on around the sport and not just about the racing, which is super interesting.
It's interesting what you said though about like F1 not necessarily caring about people watching when they're owned by a media company, which in theory you would think they want eyes on the TV at all times. So that is a very interesting point.
Well, but maybe you buy a $150 McLaren top, or maybe you interact with it on Instagram or Twitter. Yeah. And, you know, from that point, as long as people are talking about F1 and aware of it and spending money in some shape or form, I think Liberty is pretty happy with the way things are going until they possibly decide to sell it.
The $150 hats at this point. Yeah, exactly.
So let's dive into the book a little bit. I absolutely love the chapter names, which is one of the first things you see, table of contents. I'll just read some for people listening. Prancing Horse, American Exceptionalism, The Piranha Club, Magic Sauce. So two questions on this. Do you have a favorite chapter if you had to choose one? And what was the most fun to write?
Favorite chapter...
I mean, the Magic Sauce, I mean, just thinking of the names, the Magic Sauce chapter makes me smile because, you know, that was a line that we got direct from Toto Wolff's description of the kind of secret sauce that went into making Drive to Survive.
We won't do the accent.
Yeah, no. but he came to visit. He actually came to visit us here in our office in, you know, just up the street. And, you know, so that was his description. And he peeled back a lot of the sort of, you know, layers of how people inside F1 thought about everything that Liberty was trying to do when they took over the sport. And a lot of the, like, you know, strong skepticism, maybe slightly stronger than skepticism that people had towards what they were doing. You know, there's this one crazy idea that they had to put like a small kind of like golf buggy, like a
Universal Studios train kind of thing.
That would take people through the pit lane, like right during a race or whatever. And, you know, they nixed that idea as soon as they heard of it, obviously. But, but you know, I think that the genuine, you know, bewilderment and surprise that the people inside F1 had when this thing proved to be, you know, such a hit. You know, he tells the story, I mean, he's told it a million times, but, you know, of him watching the first season of Drive to Survive on the plane on the way back and thinking it's a complete disaster. And then he goes to visit his relatives and they're all, you know, for the first time ever, they're actually interested in F1 and what he does. So, you know, that was a really fun chapter too. You know, all that stuff, peeling back the layers of Drive to Survive and you know, learning that it wasn't the sort of surefire hit that it now looks, you know,
was
fun to do.
Right. That's when he said to us, you know, we still don't really know, you know, what the ingredient in the magic sauce was, and we don't know if this was a stroke of genius or a lucky punch.
Yeah.
Or a combo of the two. Who knows?
Yeah.
But now has been copied in multiple other sports, the format. Yeah. It's pretty amazing.
Do you all want to read a favorite excerpt of the book to us? or do you have?
Sure. Yeah.
Sure.
Josh, why don't you?
Sure. I think I would read from the Spygate chapter.
Yes. Oh, please. We don't shy away from controversy in this book.
I mean, we love Spygate.
Spygate has ultimately resulted in the largest ever sports fine that made the other Spygate, the one with the New England Patriots, look like peanuts.
Formula One does that well.
Bigger and better.
All right. So this is Spygate from the middle of the book. One morning in early June 2007, Trudy Coughlin walked into an unremarkable Surrey storefront with an unwieldy stack of 780 pages that she wanted transferred onto CD-ROMs. Gary Monteith, who ran the copy shop, didn't usually pay much attention to what was on his customers' pages. It was none of his business. But as he ran his thumb over the ream of paper, something printed on the sheets jumped out at him. Everywhere he looked, he saw the black prancing horse of Ferrari. Monteith had supported the Scuderia as an F1 fan for years, and if all that time had taught him anything, it was that Walton-on-Thames, Surrey, sat an awfully long way from Maranello. Sensing an opportunity for some Formula One chit-chat, Monteith asked Coughlin, "Do you work for Ferrari?" "My husband does," she stammered. "Well, he used to." The part she left out was the identity of your husband's current employer. Mike Coughlin was actually the chief designer at McLaren. The closest he'd come to wearing the red uniform of Ferrari was when he worked as an assistant under John Barnard, the designer who'd refused to move to Italy. But ever since 2002, he'd been based in Woking as one of Ron Dennis's most trusted lieutenants. This is what Monteith discovered for himself through some light investigation the moment Trudy Coughlin had left his store. He typed her name into a search engine, and a few things suddenly fell into place. It made perfect sense that the man she was married to worked for McLaren. The team's HQ was only 10 miles down the road. What didn't add up was why this McLaren guy and his wife were in possession of detailed specifications for that year's Ferrari. Something wasn't right. People didn't just waltz into his copy shop with 780 pages of highly confidential materials. They brought in utility bills and birth certificates. So Monteith decided that he needed to tell someone. But who? As a tifoso, he knew the name of Ferrari's sporting director, Stefano Domenicali, from the TV every other Sunday, and it didn't take long for Monteith to work out an email address for him. "Dear Mr. Domenicali," he began, "my name is Gary Monteith. You don't know me, but I'm a big Ferrari fan, and there's something I thought you'd want to know." Monteith's suspicion was that the 780 pages now in his possession were in fact private property of the Scuderia that had somehow fallen into enemy hands. If that were true, he could scarcely imagine the consequences. Hundreds of millions of dollars had been spent to develop the contents of this document. Every page was potentially covered in trade secrets. As far as he could guess, this might even be criminal matter. Hoping to grab Domenicali's attention, Monteith laid out his fears in the starkest possible terms, right there in capital letters in the subject line. Before hitting send, he typed out the two words that would change the course of F1 history. Industrial espionage.
Unreal.
I still get chills. That is so incredible. What was writing that chapter like about Spygate?
I mean, it was so much fun. And, you know, we spent so long trying to get the people involved to talk to us. And we even dispatch someone to Gary Monteith's house to knock on his door and deliver a letter.
Twice.
Two times.
That was one of the really fun ones. There are like, there are certain chapters in the book that require a lot of sort of, conceptual work. You know, how are we going to link these sort of seemingly disparate events together? And there are ones where you can just blow out one episode and just report it in the sort of biggest, most minute detail possible, lay out exactly what happened. And Spygate was one of those. You know, you don't need to inject any drama into Spygate, any stakes. It's like one of the craziest episodes that's ever happened in sports. So you just get to like lay it out, just blow out the thing as big as possible. And, that was really fun. It was also, I think it was the last chapter that we finished.
I think so.
So,
yeah.
That also made it, relief to finally get it done. But there were a few chapters in the book that were just so much fun to write because, the drama that you get in F1, some of the sort of insane episodes, they really just write themselves. You're just typing and putting it on the page. So, so much fun.
Well, that's not giving yourselves enough credit, but Formula One gives you a lot of material to work with, I'm sure.
The storytelling is just unbelievable. And some of these stories in Formula One, you hear them just like that, and you're like, there's no way someone could even think about that for a movie, let alone it happening in real life. So, very true. Okay, friends, it's festival and concert season, and you know it's all about the Boots this year. That's why you need to make Tecovas your number one place for festival style this spring. And don't forget to shop their seasonal and limited edition offerings, including men's and women's boots, apparel, hats, bags, and more. We love Tecovas. They have a first wear comfort, which basically means there's no break-in period. It's the best thing ever. So stop by your local Tecovas store, have a complimentary drink or two, and shop new styles. Many stores even have leather custom branding to make your boots truly personalized, and with regular live music and events, there's really no in-store experience like it. If you can't make it to a store, though, just visit tecovas.com, T-E-C-O-V-A-S.com. They offer free shipping on all boots, as well as free returns and exchanges, and they ship right to your door. Go to tecovas.com and find your new favorite pair of boots today.
One of my favorite lines from the beginning is, "The drivers, a collection of slightly built millionaires without normal human fear receptors, filtered in from their respective corners of the world, but mostly from Monaco, their favorite tax haven on the French Riviera." I feel like that just sums up the sport in such an incredible way. And F1 is so unique in that there are only 20 professional athletes in the sport. So what, in your mind, having covered many different sports, makes F1 so unique and so interesting as a sport when you compare it to others?
Well, as you point out, there's only 20 of them. You know, there are fewer active F1 drivers than there are New York Yankees when you think about iconic kind of sports things you can belong to. And so because they're there, and many of them are there for so long, you have the same people bouncing around the world doing this death-defying thing at 200 miles per hour. And you kind of wonder at what point it ever becomes kind of routine or normal for them. And the truth is, it doesn't. They go out there, risk their lives, and it makes them, I think the proximity, being around the same people all the time, makes them so crazy and petty. And the backbiting gets crazy. And I think that's what we're seeing kind of right now. Okay. With some of the off the track drama as well.
Yeah, I think, I totally agree with that. I think the one thing that we sort of think about F1, what makes it a different sport, such a unique sport, is it's like the only professional sport where they change the rules, like, hugely. Yeah.
Real time.
Like, not only in real time during the course of the season, but, like, they massively change the rules every few years,
mm-hmm.
which sort of, like, table flips the entire sport. The teams that are at the front suddenly finds itself in the middle, and the team that was in the middle suddenly jumps right to the front, just because they're willing to sort of rewrite the rule book. Every time, it's one of the ironic things that we note in the book that, like, Formula One is called Formula One because formula, like, literally refers to the specifications of the sport. This is a sport literally named after the rule book, and yet they change the rules all the time in a way that, like, totally messes up with the sport. It'd be like if the NBA just, like, removed the 3-point line one season, and, like, teams that have been constructed, like, purely around their 3-point shooting are suddenly left with, like, nothing to do. So, I think that was, like, sort of one of the sort of through lines that links a lot of the characters and the teams that we sort of unpack and bring out in the book, like, right back to the very beginning, with Colin Chapman at Lotus, one of the foremost car designers of Formula One history. The ones who have really succeeded were the ones who were able to adapt and adjust on the fly to the rules changes, and the ones who sort of spotted the loopholes and the gray areas and were able to really exploit those. And just in general, the ones who really embraced the sport's kind of commitment to reinvention.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, it's the sport where reinventing yourself season after season is really the thing that separates the teams that succeed, the teams at the front of the grid, and the teams at the back. And so if you look at the kind of history of the most influential F1 figures, from Chapman to, you know, Ron Dennis and Frank Williams, Enzo Ferrari, even Bernie Eccleston, you know, right through to today, to Toto Wolff and Christian. It's really the guys who have sort of spotted an opportunity, reinvented themselves, and done that quicker and more effectively than anyone else, and then sort of kept doing that to stay ahead.
Yeah, it's the whole, like, moving target idea of F1 is just mm-hmm. unbelievable. And we talk about this too, because in other sports, like, every team has people besides just the players. But in F1, like, that could not be more true, because you have the new regulations, you have the engineers, you have the leadership. Like, it is just so many people besides just these 20 drivers. And I think that's why the stakes feel so high and the drama is so, like, intensified, because with that moving target, like, you only have a certain amount of time to actually succeed before you have to kind of, like, start on the back foot again with everyone else. So the book goes into, I'm going to quote here, "the audacious gambles that have shaped the sport for half a century. In your opinion, what is the most audacious gamble of all?
Well, I think that one of the most audacious was, you know, and this, again, this goes back to our sort of childhood love of the Williams, you know, early Williams, the teams, the Williams teams of the early 90s, which was so dominant. And this was completely unbeknownst to me at the time. But what we later found out reporting this book was that Williams was actually sort of on a path at that moment to creating an F1 car that basically drove itself, where the driver didn't actually have to do almost anything. This was at the time, this was at a time when, you know, personal computers and computer chips were first sort of being embraced by the automotive industry. Mm-hmm. And Williams was like an absolute pioneer in terms of like using this stuff to make its car function so much better than anyone else's. You know, the biggest thing obviously was that they had this, you know, active suspension where the car could sort of see the contour of the road ahead and adjust the suspension so that it would, you know, corner without, you know, going up or down and mm-hmm. you know, being perfectly aerodynamically aligned. But they also introduced things like, you know, power steering, automatic gearboxes, anti-lock brakes, like all these sorts of things that now are sort of standard in the car industry. But back then, when, like, you know, computers were like the size of a briefcase, it was insane to have these things in a tiny little F1 car. But they were so, you know, these things were so effective that, you know, it actually sort of represented the last time that F1 cars were at the sort of very cutting edge of what the automotive industry was doing, because they then outlawed computer aids in electronic aids in F1 cars in sort of like the 1993-94 mm-hmm. season. And, you know, ever since then, that sort of whole realm has pushed forward without F1 being involved at all. But literally, Williams was at a stage where they could plonk basically any driver in the car and they would... But they'd be guaranteed to win the world championship.
Could have been you.
Yeah, it could literally could be any of us.
Instead, it was Nigel Mansell.
Yeah, exactly.
same.
That's so interesting. Yeah, we talk a little bit about what role F1 can or should be playing in the broader automotive industry these days. And obviously, we have Formula E, which is all electric, and, you know, Formula One is trying to get to net zero by 2030. But yeah. I'm curious your thoughts on that these days, if you think F1 has a role to play in the broader industry at all.
I mean, when you go to Maranello, they tell you there's one side of the street that is for road car development and one side of the street for F1. And what they really want is everything from this side of the street to eventually make its way across to the road cars. And they did that with things like KERS and various smaller pieces of technology like that. But we're at a stage now where, as John was explaining, the two are kind of on separate tracks.
Yeah.
And, you know, they still talk in Formula One with great reverence for the combustion engine, which is not really something you hear in the rest of the auto industry.
I sort of think that sort of idea that F1 is like the R&D department for the automotive has always been a little bit overblown. Mm. I think there have been things that have sort of worked their way across, but... I think, you know, F1 has been far more effective as like a branding exercise for the automotive giants than for actually, you know, engineering breakthroughs.
Yeah, no, I think that makes a lot of sense. So going back a little bit to Drive to Survive and the magic sauce that we were talking about, I'm curious what you think that is. Like, what made Drive to Survive so successful? What helped propel its growth? I know it's not only Drive to Survive, but what is that magic sauce?
I mean, some of it was timing. Season 2 of Drive to Survive, the first one with Ferrari and Mercedes in it, came out February 28th, if I'm not mistaken, 2020.
Yeah.
So that was 2 weeks before everyone spent a year on the couch.
And watching TV.
Yeah.
That's how I got into the sport.
So that's one piece of it, and it's why we haven't necessarily seen the same kind of uptick from the other Netflix Drive to Survive style shows. There was also a larger reinvention of the way F1 was broadcast. And when we spoke a lot to a guy named David Hill, who was brought in, and he's a veteran of the NFL and the Premier League, to reinvent the visual look of F1. And he told us about freaking out every time he saw guys walking around with their helmets on. He was like, no, get the helmets off. We need to see their faces. These are people, and these are our gladiators. So we need people to connect with them in that way. And that was one huge change.
I think that was a huge thing. And I think that when you mentioned about how so many other sports are trying to do what Drive to Survive did, I think, you know, it's difficult. You think of something like tennis. We may not know a lot about the tennis players themselves, but even in just the course of watching a tennis match, you can see their facial expressions, you can see how they react with the crowd, you can see how they react with their opponent, with the umpire, with their coaches. You kind of get a sense for what that, what those athletes are like, just by virtue of being able to watch them. That was something that you never were able to do with F1, right? Yeah. You literally, they have a helmet covering their entire face. You can't see what their, you know, how their facial expressions are changing. You can't really see anything about them. So they were such a sort of cast of, you know, famous but very unknowable characters, that it took something like Drive to Survive to actually bring out the personalities behind the helmets. And I think that was the sort of that was the stroke of genius of the show, right? That once you're invested in the personalities in the cars, then all of a sudden what's happening in the middle of the pack and what's happening at the back of the grid is so much more, you know, it resonates so much more than just like who came first, who came second, who came third.
Yeah, and then you only have 20 to get to know, right. So it's just a much lower barrier to entry in terms of actually buying into it.
And we now get more radio transmissions than ever before. I mean, one of the very first races they ever had radio transmission between the FIA and the pit walls was Abu Dhabi 21.
Yep.
So we were right there to hear, you know, no, Michael, this is so not right.
Yeah, that's a good transition. Exactly. To Abu Dhabi.
we do love the radio too, that we do a segment every week called Radio of the Week because it's just too good. So speaking of Abu Dhabi, there have been a lot of controversial topics and events in Formula One. We've already talked about a few, but in our sort of recent history, most notably, it's Abu Dhabi. You also talk to controversial figures as well. You interviewed Bernie Eccleston in his home. Tell us what it's like to cover these really controversial topics. Do you feel like you have to be super, you can't really give your opinion, you have to just say it how it is, or do you feel like you can sort of put a little bit of your own spin on it?
I mean, so Abu Dhabi, I'll let Josh talk about Bernie Eccleston. Punt that one. But Abu Dhabi was probably the most fun that we've ever had writing any chapter of any book.
I can imagine.
I think we wrote it almost as quickly as it takes to watch the actual race. That was another one where, you're basically being a neutral observer. You're just literally laying out exactly what happened and letting the action and the sort of completely head-wrecking events of that race speak for themselves, right? I mean, that it was just drama that you couldn't have scripted.
Yeah.
So you just lay it out. I mean, I remember we got when we spoke to, you know, we had a few meetings with Toto, and on one of them we just grilled him about Abu Dhabi for like 30 minutes straight, and he desperately tried to change the topic of conversation all the time, and I felt awful. But I'd be like, just going back one more time to Abu Dhabi. Even here, you know, he in the book, you know, talks about how controversial it is. He says, you know, at the Christmas table, there's three things you're not allowed to talk about: Trump, COVID, and Abu Dhabi 21. but he was actually, you know, after prodding him for like 27 minutes, he finally sort of like opened up about what he actually thought about it. But you know, just incredible, incredible drama, and so fun to sort of relay that story. And now with sort of passing of time and being able to put everything in the exact context, because, you know, at the time we didn't even realize what a sort of monumental shift that would be in the course of F1 history.
Yeah.
And I think if we'd known, it would have been even crazier, right? That this would be the sort of very end, like the very dying embers of the Mercedes dynasty.
Yeah. And the real time, I think reenaction maybe is not the right word, but of what Toto went through in that moment is so cool in the book, him calling Gene Todd and his response was like, I was like, oh my gosh, it's so cool.
The thing about that moment too, in this, like the FIA, like talk about the formula, talk about the rule book, like that's one thing that Formula One is just like always thinking on the fly, but that's what is always happening. So I can only imagine how frustrating it must be when you feel like you have a true case, but the rule book may or may not align, and you have to see the gray area.
It's insane. It's a sport with the thickest rule book you could imagine, and yet everywhere you look, it seems there's like wide open gray
area. There's a new scenario.
Oh, there's
every
not
year.
Really a rule for this. We'll just have to sort of make it up on the fly. Yeah.
And what was just as crazy is that anyone watching at home had no idea these rules even existed.
Yeah.
I mean, we're all kind of discovering it in real time, you know, as Michael Masi is talking about them. And then it's like you listen and it's like Toto, like, oh, Toto sounds right here. Well, maybe Christian has a point. And then you see the world championship like flipping on
happened
a
so fast.
Yeah. Even when we were writing the chapter, we were like sort of desperately trying to wrap our head around wait, what was the rule again? It was like you had to unlap this, but then there has to be an extra lap. And but so, you know, I mean, you know, Michael Massey is obviously a very controversial figure, but I don't really envy him having to make all those decisions in real time.
I hope he's enjoying his life
so
in Australia.
Stressful. Even just to think about it years later is so stressful. So I can't imagine what it was like.
And
to,
it still makes
Toto
mad.
Yeah, I know.
Oh, I can only imagine.
Not nice about him.
Okay, so Bernie Eccleston.
Bernie, I mean, was this towering figure in F1 for four decades. And, you know, in the British press, he's still called the Supremo of F1, which is not a real title, but stuck to him. And
that's the name of the chapter.
It is. Yep. And we chased him for months until finally one day I get a get a call from a British cell phone and he says, "Hello, it's Bernie."
Direct.
Yeah. And we start talking and I said, "Can I come see you in Switzerland?" And he says, "Yes, pick a day." So eventually I make my way there. I call him once I'm there and he says, "I suppose you'll want an address. Here's my wife." So the next morning at the appointed hour, I walk up to this enormous chalet in Gstaad.
Oh,
and,
my God.
Chalet Eagle.
Chalet Eagle was the name. And wind up in his living room for about 3 hours.
Wow.
As he just unspools anything I wanted to talk about, really. And being in there was kind of crazy because he explained to me how he still watches every session of every Grand Prix, from practice to qualifying to the race. And being surrounded by all this really kind of British stuff. He has a life-size Beefeater and a life-size London police officer. Kind of, it's really weird.
Was there any like very unique F1 memorabilia?
Not that I saw in his living room. I did see a lot of not unique porcelain bulldogs.
Roscoe's? Mini Roscoe's?
They felt like they long predated Roscoe and might, you know, might survive into history. But he was happy to talk about anything and did not shy away from the controversial stuff either. Talked about back when he was trying to get a race behind the Iron Curtain first, you know, in the Soviet Union and then in Hungary, and told me about how he quite liked dealing with the KGB because they got things done and they, you know, they were straight shooters as far as he was concerned.
Is there anything that, I mean, it feels like a lot of things that he said probably surprised you, but was there anything in particular that really stands out, maybe besides what you just said?
I mean, the KGB really sits at the top.
You don't forget that.
I think, like, honestly, I was surprised about the thing that he still watches so closely. I mean, obviously, like, you know, guy who's in charge for so long, but especially as he's like kind of been blackballed by F1, you know, he's like definitely persona non grata, that Liberty has sort of quite successfully kind of airbrushed Bernie from history. And, you know, the fact that he's still so invested in it, despite the fact that he's clearly not welcome, is kind of a crazy thing. I mean, I guess it's inevitable for someone who spent like literally their entire life building the sport. But yeah, it's sort of like, I don't know, a little sad, you know, to think about. Yeah.
He's probably doing okay in Castle Eagle
Chalet Eagle, or whatever.
I think he's doing fine. Yeah, he just settled his latest tax evasion case, so I'm sure he's doing fine.
Great. Well, last question. We talked a little bit about if F1 growth is sustainable or not, but where do you feel like F1 is headed in the next 5 to 10 years?
I think they're facing a lot of big questions now, and we see it playing out in real time about what comes after Drive to Survive, what comes after that huge bump. And we're seeing them throw a lot of darts at the board right now.
Yeah.
You know, whether it's the Apple, Brad Pitt, Jerry Bruckheimer project that is now delayed till 2025, whether it's, you know, doing things like F1 for kids and all of these different things as they try to recreate a new magic sauce that no one knows how it's going to taste, but they definitely want to stick around long enough for either a sale to someone, who that might be. You know, it's been rumored to be Saudi Arabia at some ludicrous price. It could happen. But certainly I think the success surprised even them. And now they're on this super high plane and kind of scrambling around for oxygen, trying to figure out how they're going to stay there.
I don't think that there's a scenario, though, where they sort of just like drop right back to where they were before.
Yeah.
You know, like I think that the profile that it's got now and the fact that, you know, the audience numbers that it now generates has sort of like almost like sort of normalized F1 and brought it into the sort of sports mainstream in this country, that even if the popularity does dwindle somewhat, it still feels like a sort of accepted part of the of the sort of sports landscape here. In the same way that soccer, you know, now feels like a sort of normal part of the American sports culture, whereas like 25 years ago, it would still felt like a very kind of niche European kind of, you know, strange pursuit. So I think F1 has sort of done, you know, the hard part in that, like, the profile that it's got now and the fact that it's sort of seen as like totally normal to tune into an F1 race on a weekend means that they have a sort of floor, you know, in terms of like interest that like they won't ever go back down to sort of where they were before.
Now we just need an American version of Max Verstappen and then we're unstoppable.
That's it.
Looking at you, Logan.
2026 rules changes. Maybe it could be the thing that does it.
Well, thank you both so much. The formula is live for everyone to get now. This was such a treat.
And thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for having us.
So fun.
This is great.